Hey, welcome back to another episode of Parker's Pensies. I'm your host, Parker Setacase, and this is a podcast where we explore all the deepest ideas in philosophy, theology, nature, and life. I love thinking about cool stuff, so come think with me. Today's episode is a very, very special episode. I say that all the time because they all are very special, but this one is especially special. I have with me Dr. Greg Welty, and we're going to be talking about his new book, Alvin Plantinga, which is in the Great Thinkers series for Presbyterian and Reformed, PNR Publishing. And I've had a lot of these authors from the Great Thinker series on. They're great books. I love them. I've enjoyed all the ones that I had so far. This one's no different. It's fantastic. It might be a little bit longer than the other ones in the series, but it's like 150 pages on Alvin Plantinga, and it's like tight and concise and really, really rich. So stay tuned, you guys. We're going to be mostly focused on the problem of evil and the evidential problem of evil, but we'll see where the conversation goes, as you guys know, who are regular listeners. Before we jump in, I want to thank everyone who's making this podcast happen over on Patreon. If you guys like this podcast, please consider supporting me there. You can find the link in the description. Help keep the lights on, help feed my dog, Theophilus. And if you guys don't like Patreon for some reason, you can also support me here on YouTube if you're watching there through the YouTube members program. So you can find the link somewhere down here, YouTube members. That would be huge. All right, well, let's stop commodifying ourselves and jump in with Dr. Greg Welty to talk about Alvin Plantinga. Dr. Welty, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Sure, no problem. It's really good to be here. I'm glad this is an extra special episode. Sort of sounds like maybe an after school special, you know, you don't want to miss.
That's right.
But good. I know it's taken a while to get me on here. So
yeah, that's right.
All due to me.
This is awesome. Well, yeah. And so I mentioned this off air, but I just wanted to start with a quick thank you because I emailed you and James Anderson a few years back. And, you know, I don't expect you guys to recall that or anything. A bunch of people emailing you. But I said, hey, I want to be like you guys. I want to be a Calvinistic philosopher. I want to be, you know, top notch. And both of you gave me very similar advice saying, hey, why don't you go learn some theology before you jump into philosophy and see if you still want to. And so I got two master's degrees from TEDS in systematic theology and theological studies. And now I'm working on philosophy of religion, and Lord willing, I'll continue on into philosophy. But both of you, God has used in my life to set the trajectory of my life. So that's pretty wild. Thank you for that.
No problem. I think I remember giving you this lengthy list of sources and saying, well, yeah, you know, some Christian philosophers, it's at least possible to defend a version of Christianity that's not worth defending. So you might want to, if God gives you time and opportunity, to learn things like biblical languages, church history, principles of exegesis, so that you avoid thinking, I don't know, neo-Apollinarianism on the incarnation is, you know, really a great thing or something like that, right? At least know what the options are and be able to approach your philosophical studies with that in the background. So, you know, it's great if you can get that. So I'm glad that was of use.
Yeah, totally. Well, before we jump into Alvin Plantinga, who is a Christian philosopher in his own right, a bunch of things, we can characterize him in a bunch of different ways, and we will. I want to just ask about Plantinga's definition of philosophy and maybe your definition of philosophy. Many people will know in the audience that Plantinga says philosophy is thinking hard about something. I just wanted to get your take. What do you make of that definition? And then how would you define philosophy yourself?
Right. I don't know if I quote that particular definition in the book. I think I have, you know, heard it. I mean, it's notoriously difficult to define the discipline. So at one level, you know, thinking really hard or thinking about thinking might strike many people as just as good as an attempt as any other. There is the always definition by example. You just sort of point at these various sub-disciplines or journals and say, do what they do, enter the conversation, you know, we're done. I don't really know. I mean, etymologically, of course, love of wisdom is always there, but that just invites a lot of further questions. In months of the syllabi for my classes here at Southeastern, I have like a fundamental definition of philosophy that then I adapt for the different syllabi, so I don't have to keep on reinventing the wheel. But it includes everything that I just sort of want to communicate to the students. So it's something like philosophy is articulating and evaluating arguments, pro and con, for the truth and coherence of fundamental claims. Now, there's a lot packed in there, like J.I. Packer, packing in all the words. But each part of that is important. So you're both articulating arguments of your own, all right? You then are evaluating arguments of others. These are arguments that are either for or against the truth of fundamental claims, or sometimes the coherence of fundamental claims. And so I'm really big on the idea that the lifeblood of philosophy is arguments, right? If you just study post-it notes, summaries, Reader's Digest summaries of positions, but have no idea why the thinker arrived at that position, you're doing history philosophy, not really philosophy, right? So apologies to Anthony Kenney, who's a great philosopher in his own right, you know, but history of philosophy is not philosophy. So this is what we do over and over in class, is articulate and evaluate arguments. And then the other part of that is the truth and coherence of fundamental claims, right? And maybe you know, there's one thing to wonder, is this claim true? If so, what reason do we have to think it's true? It's another thing to ask, you know, is it even possible with this claim to be true? Is it intelligible? And philosophers think about both of these matters. Finally, in like fundamental, you know, these are fundamental claims. So fundamental is relative to discipline. So maybe there's fundamental claims taken for granted in science. So then there's philosophy of science. If you're talking about a different domain, knowledge, you get epistemology. Another domain, being, you get metaphysics, and so on. So that might be a way to at least give a synopsis of the kind of activities that we do under philosophy.
Yeah, that's great. That's really helpful. I'm reminded of you quoting Plantinga here in the book about his time at Yale, where he seemed like a lot of the students and some of the professors would rehearse different arguments and the history, maybe the history of philosophy. But he was lamenting that he wasn't learning how to do philosophy. He wasn't being taught to actually do it himself, at least partially there. And I think of that with myself, and I'm really glad to be at Palm Beach Atlantic, where we're learning to do philosophy ourselves. So that's really fun. When you think about Christian philosophy, I think of Kant's What is Enlightenment? And he talks about nonage, and he talks about, you know, dare to use your own reason and not be confessional. Can you help us out? Like, is there anything off limits for a confessional philosopher when it comes to analyzing and scrutinizing beliefs?
Well, I mean, at one level, I'm going to say no. I mean, we should be interested in examining, right, arguments for and against the truth and coherence of our distinctive Christian claims wherever and whenever we find them, right? So I guess, broadly speaking, I take on board a kind of perspective of Thomas Aquinas, right, who examines so many different kinds of, you know, arguments for Christian claims as well as against Christian claims. And he has a kind of faith, right, that if there are arguments, for instance, opposed to our views, then either somewhere the argument has gone wrong, right, there's a consistent argument that's gone wrong, or maybe they've misunderstood what we as Christians mean by the terms we use. So it's a kind of opportunity for us to clarify further what we mean, right? So I'm not saying that Aquinas' view is Plantinga's view. Plantinga's view seems to be, as I bring out in the chapter on methodology, right, that we can just sort of unabashedly in our arguments themselves sort of just start with Christian convictions, right, and not have to give a lengthy prolegomena on behalf of those. So, I mean, that's Plantinga working out what he sees as implications from his Dutch Reformed heritage there on topics pertaining to education and philosophy. You know, I just tend to say in class, yeah, Christian philosophy, studying the realms of truth, being, and value from a Christian, you know, perspective, right? So take on board any insights you have from the scriptures. At the very least, the scriptures have veto power over various conclusions we might reach. But you definitely, I think no arguments should be off limits, right? As somehow intrinsically corrosive of our faith, right? God's able to make the wrath of man praise him. So I think all of these arguments, even those against us, can be for the greater good. So, you know, real generic pious approach to the entire thing. Completely fallible.
No, that's really good. I think some people worry, you know, if you hold to the Westminster or the you know, 1689, and there's stuff about simplicity in there, then it's like, well, I can't, you know, I've signed on to this document, so I can't scrutinize that position of God's divine simplicity. I've affirmed it. But like you're saying, no, there's nothing off limits. You can still scrutinize, you can still reason through and hopefully, you know, defend that doctrine of simplicity, for instance.
Yeah, I remember. Sorry to jump in. I'm remembering an exchange. This happened a long time ago, like around the year 2000. It was at the Gifford Bequest Conference. It was in Aberdeen, Scotland. And I think Robert Coons was there. He was giving a very complicated version of the cosmological argument. I think Evan Fales, right, a noted atheist, was there as well. I hope I'm not misattributing the comment, but I remember Evan Fales saying, well, you know, it's all great that you're really into Aquinas and all the rest, but there's no way that he can actually be a philosopher. And it's because to be a philosopher, you have to have a kind of neutrality. And all of Aquinas's conclusions in the big areas, right, they're not up for grabs. They're already pre-selected for him by the church or whatever relevant authorities he trusts apart from reason. And that sort of disqualifies him at the outset from being a philosopher. Now, I remember Kuhn sort of pushing back, you know, against that. And of course, someone like Plantinga would as well, that your prior convictions, you should just be honest about them and, you know, state them and then pursue your philosophy in the midst of it. You know, Plantinga is big on conditionalization, right? If this Christian doctrine were the case, I'm not saying I have good arguments that it is, but if it were the case, here's how it would affect how we formulate, you know, such and such. And that can be, you know, that can be useful. And he even cites secular philosophers who are doing pretty much the same thing. Scott Atran on, you know, a kind of socio, you know, biology when it comes to religion. I'm not rendering a judgment as to religious beliefs are true or false, but from this strictly speaking scientific point of view, purely empirical, here's, you know, the best explanation. And Plantinga says, I have no problem with that. So conditionalization might actually help various sides to have a more robust discussion in the midst of a lot of controversies about neutrality. So sorry to interrupt.
Yeah. No, please, man. This is awesome. This is why you're here. So good. Well, okay, so in the foreword is written by Bill Davis, a student of Plantinga, and he makes this insightful point that there are Christian philosophers who are meant to speak to fellow Christians, and then there are Christian philosophers who are meant to speak to fellow philosophers. And I love this point, and this is something you mentioned in the notes you sent that you kind of picked up from your study in writing this book. Can you help us flesh that out a little bit more, and then maybe give some examples of people from each category?
Yeah, so I think what he's talking about are Christian philosophers, but then it's not so much an absolute contrast, but a kind of relative contrast in callings, right? A kind of difference of emphasis. This is based on the individuals, maybe their gifts, their environment, their opportunities at the time. So they're Christian philosophers, but then are they largely called to speak to fellow Christians about philosophy, right? Maybe like Christians as a group are like completely clueless about this, and why is this important? And what's going on in philosophy? Is it a threat? Is it a help? And so you can be a Christian philosopher who is a kind of interpreter of philosophy to your fellow Christians. And I think some of the people he names there are like Francis Schaeffer and Gordon Clark, Cornelius Van Til, John Frame, right? Largely, though not exclusively, largely their audience is other Christians, right? And they're writing to really help their fellow Christians and church to think about this matter of philosophy. So those would be Christian philosophers who are largely, not exclusively, largely called to speak to fellow Christians about philosophy. But then I think Davis talks about another kind of emphasis, and that is you're called to speak to other philosophers about Christianity. And I mean, I'm sort of reticent to use this word, but it's a bit more maybe evangelistic in that sort of the audience for which you're writing, right, is largely secular publishers. You're entering into that discussion very robustly. Again, this contrast is relative, not absolute, right?
Right.
And so they're speaking to fellow philosophers about Christianity and bringing out maybe implications, right? Which is why what's really unique about Plantinga is that he rises to prominence in the 1960s. And from there on out, he is actually drawing upon themes in Augustine and Anselm and Boethius, right? And Molina, Calvin, Edwards, Luther, Bovink, right? This is like unheard of for like a Christian philosopher to do that. But again, the audience is so often just like secular journals in philosophy, secular presses, you know, 1967, Cornell University Press, Got Another Mind, stuff like that, that really put them on the map. Yeah. And so sort of, you know, at least some secular philosophers sort of you know, give notice, right? They take notice of this, that he's addressing them and he's analyzing arguments they're interested in as secularists. So maybe there's, this would include Plantinga, this would be the second category, maybe Swinburne, maybe the Adams family, which is what we called them at UCLA, right? Bob and Marilyn Adams. Yeah. I don't know, maybe William Alston. There do seem to be some philosophers who are like right split down the middle, right? And maybe I think of like Paul Hilm like this, right? Like Paul Hilm,
okay.
Monograph on the Timelessness of God. Right. But then, you know, he has a lot of really practical, helpful work for fellow Christians. Right. Yeah. So that's pretty much, I think, the distinction that Bill Davis, is getting at there.
Yeah. I love that distinction. I think it can be helpful, for even just thinking about different thinkers. And when you're reading a book, is this for other Christians or is this for the, and that'll help you evaluate, how successful the book is. And if you are writing a book, it can help you even, just being mindful of your audience is always going to be helpful in knowing how to write and what to write. So I really appreciated that distinction. Most of my audience is going to know who Alvin Plantinga is, but I thought, if we just give like a brief characterization, like who is this guy, that a book would be written about him in that Great Thinker series.
Right. Yes. That's really chapter one. By the way, if you go to the PNR site for the book, they give you like the preface forward in chapter one for free. So you can like,
oh, wow.
Download that. And chapter one is mainly just autobiographical, in that Plantinga himself has written a couple of very lengthy pieces, Self-Profile and A Christian Life Partly Lived, right? That I try to condense and sort of bring out the points about, his life and his upbringing, convictions. And then I try to adjudicate, right, this matter of, does he deserve to be a great thinker, right? You ask Plantinga, he might say, oh, you know, I don't have any great, you know, spiritual experiences. I'm just like every other regular Christian. I mean, I quote him to that effect. But I mean, real briefly then, so he was born in 1932. So I think he celebrated his 90th birthday last year, my son Ricard. Mm-hmm. let's see, has a kind of like Dutch Reformed upbringing. Right. So that will mean something maybe to some of your listeners in terms of the three forms of unity. Right. Yeah. The Heidelberg Catechism, Belgian Confession, Canons of Dort. Right. Him being catechized. Right. And just hearing sermons and things like that really did have an influence on him. It affected his view of education as not religiously neutral because that's part of that tradition. It affected his view of philosophy, which he largely got from a mentor at Calvin College, where he got his bachelor's.
Jellema?
Yes, that's right. That philosophy is at bottom a kind of rivalry between fundamental religious alternatives, right? Yeah. In fact, 30 years before Plantinga was at Calvin College, I mean, Cornelius Van Til is a student there. Plantinga's there, right. People like Nicholas Wolterstorff are his classmates. But real briefly then, Dutch Reformed upbringing, goes to Calvin College, then he gets an MA at University of Michigan, then he goes on and gets his PhD at Yale. Then his first teaching gig is at Wayne State University for about 5 years. You mentioned earlier about, you know, just learning how to do philosophy. Plantinga felt like he really learned to do philosophy at Wayne State because of just this camaraderie among his colleagues. And yeah. He's like, once in a while we did lectures. But really, we just debated philosophy. But like one of his colleagues was Edmund Gettier, you know, like Gettier cases,
it's
right?
Crazy.
Hector Castaneda, you know, all these Keebler.
I think Yandel might have been there too. Do you know?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
I think they were colleagues.
I almost had Yandel as my supervisor at the PhD level, but I decided overseas. But yeah, so we went back and forth a little bit. But anyway, Wayne State, then about 20 years teaching at Calvin College, then about maybe 30 years at University of Notre Dame, right? So, I mean, we're talking a teaching career that spans over 50 years, right? So the way I summarize in the book is quantity and quality. And in terms of his output, why I think that he's like a great thinker, right? So like quantity, think about somebody who writes on average 3 peer-reviewed articles in philosophy a year for 60 years, right? Yeah. Just do the math, right? Like that's just enormous, right? This isn't like my blog posts or something, right? So 14 books, right? Written all the monographs and books that are about him. I think I count like 21, 22 books, over a 30-year period, you know, written about him. I mean, I don't have a single book written about me, right? Rightly so. Imagine if you have
not yet. It might be coming. Yeah, it might be coming down the line.
Maybe in the next slide. But imagine, you know, all of these books. So many doctoral dissertations. You know, my own dissertation at Oxford is a kind of blow up 300 page long of like a paragraph in 2 dozen or so arguments for the existence of God in some unpublished lecture by Plantinga, right? James Anderson, right? It's all about Plantinga's epistemology, and you know, on it goes. So there's the quantity of the work, the quality of the work. I think I've already mentioned, right? All of the different Christian philosophers that he thought he took to be relevant to doing philosophy, even in a secular realm, right? Mm-hmm. Sightings of these Christian thinkers were relatively rare prior to Plantinga's career, like in actual journals, except for maybe Roman Catholic journals of philosophy, right? They're sort of, right, you know, faithfully preserving, right, a lot of what's good in the Christian tradition. But outside of that, I mean, you're not going to find it in mainstream secular journals. But things have sort of changed. And so I think he deserves to be a candidate for a great thinker because of his influence on a whole, you know, the discussion, maybe philosophical practice, particularly among Christians who maybe are a bit bolder in being open about what their convictions are and what they might imply. Plus, he's one of the few Christian philosophers who has really given a lot of thought to what does it mean to be a Christian philosopher, as opposed to like just being a philosopher who happens to be a Christian. Like, what is that all about? And what are the things that, if you want, like, you know, what can Plantinga nerds learn about, you know, Plantinga here? What struck me was how difficult that question was for him. I thought, well, he's written about 5 or 6 pieces on method in Christian philosophy. It must have been really easy for him. But he says in his autobiographical pieces, this is one of the hardest things that I had to address to my own satisfaction, is what does it mean to be a Christian philosopher instead of just a philosopher who happens to be a Christian? So I get into that in the chapter on method, because he has 5 methodological principles and 4 activities, and stuff like that. So I'll pause there, just to say that the book examines his thought and tries to give accessible summaries of his thought in 5 areas, right? So faith and reason, problem of evil, theistic arguments, divine attributes, religion and science, and then maybe philosophical method, and then finally how he relates to the Reformed heritage, which is especially relevant for Plantinga, because of course, unlike, you know, Dawkins or Kant or whatever, that actually is his tradition from which he's coming.
Yeah, man, good memory. It's almost like you've been working on this for a while or something.
I've been afraid of all these podcasts because I wrote the book a year ago, right? Like I've moved on completely to this other book on the problem of evil, right? This 40 questions on suffering and evil book that I'm trying to finish up. So it's sort of, you know, I can't really use that as an excuse, right? I was at this APA session, William and Craig and Peter Van Der Wagen, and they start asking Craig questions about his Abstract Objects book, right? Which is the whole reason we're here. And like the first thing out of his mouth is, oh, well, actually I've moved on to, the atonement book, you know, all the rest. I was like, hey, like, this is what this thing's about. You know, I mean, I'm sure he was just joking and breaking the ice. He was versatile on any topic they asked him about, but yeah, that's, I am trying to remember, all the stuff. I have flipped through the book.
I love that. So I want to get into some evil stuff. But, you know, first, you've got this really cool pedigree yourself at UCLA with the Adams family. You went to Westminster with Frame, and then Oxford with Swinburne. And then you sent me your dissertation, you know, years and years ago, and I've been just like slavishly reading over it. I love that. But even seeing the people on your board is like insane. Davies and all these folks. So I wanted to ask you, as someone who has studied under Swinburne and then wrote a book on Plantinga, to give a characterization, you do in the book a little bit as well, between the two. And I don't want to ask like the great question, because that's kind of gross. Like, who's the greatest of the Christians who are supposed to be humble, you know? But can you characterize maybe their positions and the way that they do philosophy?
Yeah. I mean, I don't find a lot of usefulness in like, you know, who's the greatest kind of kind of questions. I mean, what do you get out of that? What are you supposed to do after somebody gives you the case? Like, you know, bow down, we're not worthy.
It might come
across to some people that, you know, I think Plantinga is like the fourth person of the Trinity and worthy of appropriate worship. I mean, nothing could be further from the truth, right? I mean, these individuals, whether it's Plantinga or Swinburne, I mean, they're not above us in the clouds. They're not like beneath us, right, to just stomp on with impunity. They're by our sides, right? They help us. And sort of thinking through some very difficult issues, right? I mean, there are mysteries and then there are mysteries. And, you know, Trinity, Incarnation, Atonement, I mean, we're saddled with a lot, right? We need all the help that we can get. So I think we should view these individuals as allies. So the question was really like on how they, adjudicating them. It's funny, random thought, like, it was a year ago or relatively recently, like the philosopher of mind, Colin McGinn, actually wrote a blog post. You can look it up. And he basically gives an argument. I'm the best philosopher living, you know, and he makes like this objective case from all of his writings, and which I thought was funny. Maybe one thing that I let on in the book is number one, the great contrast between Plantinga and Swinburne and how that was sort of bewildering to me. Right. Yeah. When I went overseas to England in like about, you know, 1998 for those 5 years for the infill and defill, you know, Plantinga had, I'm sure, risen to prominence in a kind of American context. And, you know, it was sort of a sense of bowing down. We're not worthy. Oh, he's just so amazing. But like you go over there and the Brits are having none of it. They're just like, this guy has his head in Platonic clouds. We're about ordinary language philosophy here. Are his arguments any good? They weren't gonna give anything to the arguments. I think Plantinga and Swinburne are the two most influential Christian philosophers in the second half of the 20th century. Of course, the transformation of the scene, to the extent that's happened, I think that can be overstated. There might even be a bit of a backlash against that assessment. Nowadays, we ought not to be, you know, really focusing on, you know, how the culture perceives us, right? Just keep your head down and do, you know, do good work. And maybe though dead, maybe you will speak. that kind of thing. But there's a big contrast between them, right? And that was bewildering to me. So Swinburne's like an internalist when it comes to epistemology, like his book Epistemic Justification, Faith and Reason. Plantinga is much more of an externalist. Swinburne thinks skeptical theism just isn't a great strategy when it comes to the problem of evil. You can read his preface to his 1998 book, Providence and the Problem of Evil. He thinks it leads to moral skepticism, right? It's just, it's not a price worth paying to do skeptical theism. Plantinga thinks skeptical theism is like the next best thing to sliced bread. He pursues it a lot in chapter 14, Awards to Christian Belief and in other venues. Swinburne thinks cumulative case natural theology is just really awesome, you know, souped up Bayesianism, this kind of thing. We can make a case, existence of God is more likely than not. Plantinga is like, principle dwindling probabilities. I'm not sure you can get a lot, you know, from that. Swinburne thinks that God's ignorance of the future is vast. I mean, that's a quote from his book, The Christian God. So definitely not just an open theist, but the inspirer of open theists, you know, the person whom Clark Pinnock cites when Pinnock
wants a big deal.
Explain his open theism. Yeah. Plantinga has an undiminished, conception of divine foreknowledge. Swinburne thinks Molinism just can't work, right? Free will foreknowledge dilemma is also just, pretty good, Pike's version of it. Plantinga thinks you can use Occam's way out. Plantinga thinks Molinism is great. Swinburne's like logically necessary existence of God. Plantinga's like, yeah, sure. You know, maximal greatness. So, there was very bewildering for me because I was like, they both have like this Christian profession, right? What am I supposed to do? And this conflict sort of just taught me to be a philosopher, right? You just have to examine this. And this might disappoint some of you hearers. I'm very sketchy about non-eclectic approaches. I'm very sketchy about like, you have this entire system bequeathed to you by the master and you can't tweak one little part of it, because if you do, then you should be labeled as a compromiser and all the rest. I just, you need to study the arguments, let the chips fall where they may. And so, you know, I'm not really answering your question, I guess, because this is a long way of avoiding, right?
It's helpful.
They're doing different things, right? I mean, Flanagan doesn't attempt Swinburne's cumulative case, natural theology, right? He doesn't have that kind of highly integrated trilogy in that area. He has another highly integrated trilogy, right, in epistemology. So sometimes different people are doing different things. And actually, I think that's also what's going on with respect to like evidentialism and classical natural theology on the one hand, and transcendental arguments for God's existence on the other hand. My master metaphor here is like the trunk of the tree, right? And so some thinkers are saying, hey, do you know that if you accept these things, you might have some really good reason to believe in God? You know, these fundamental principles of causality or sense experience or logic. There might be others who are saying, hey, you know, this trunk really needs roots, right? How do you account for this trunk? Right.
Yeah.
Those aren't contradictory approaches. They're just doing different things. Yeah. They're touching different parts of the tree as opposed to the elephant.
Can't use the elephant.
So I get from frame a kind of, you know, I guess I'm fundamentally a peacemaker. Maybe that means I'm a compromiser. I don't know.
Depends on who you ask.
So I'll stop babbling, but definitely a Swinburne Flanagan contrast. I think that's entirely healthy and salutary for Christian philosophy to have these philosophers rise to prominence and bequeath the next generation with a lot of helpful thought that then we sort through. I mean, our, you know, our justification doesn't depend upon this, right? We have a kind of, kind of freedom to think things out, right? God's already met our greatest need.
Amen. Well, and that's something I wanted to bring out as well. And I've had a similar experience when I was learning about these two. I just want to follow somebody. Just tell me what to believe. And it's like, that's so anti-philosophical. But you can't do it because the two leading ones completely disagree on so much. And it's almost like God orchestrated that so that you couldn't just follow one without, you know, it's like, good luck, because this guy exists and he completely disagrees and they both love God, you know, so.
Yeah, that's
really
possible.
That.
I don't want to divine the purpose of God, you know.
No, of course not.
But definitely you can see how there's that kind of diversity. And Paul actually has a kind of argument in Corinthians for there must be differences among you to see who would have God's approval and on that kind of thing. I mean, God, there's a kind of divine wisdom, right? And and allowing this. So I think it's okay if it's a buzzing, blooming confusion to a certain degree.
Sure. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, with that, let's get into some evil stuff. These are some arguments against God, and you break it down into, you know, Plantinga and his responses to logical problems of evil, or the logical problem of evil, and evidential problem of evil, whether those are families or not, whatever. Most of my audience will know Plantinga's response to the logical problem of evil, so maybe we can just kind of like wave at that, and then you go in, there's a lot of replies to the evidential problem of evil. And I thought those will be more, my audience will be less familiar with those. So maybe just, can you broach Mackey's argument? And then, I mean, it's just free will, right? So Plantinga uses the free will argument, but maybe we can just, wave at it as we go back. Yeah.
Maybe. So I actually, I discovered a lot that I ought to have known. I mean, I've been teaching through this material for a while, but sort of getting a bird's eye view of like the body of work that Plantinga has produced. Yeah. I hadn't actually said it before me. So I hadn't discerned prior to the writing of the book that Plantinga gives at least seven distinct replies to the problem of evil. Essentially, by my counting, two replies to the logical argument and then five replies to the evidential argument. And it also surprised me that actually libertarian free will, either its possibility or its value or its both, is only really required for two of those replies. Something similar with classical theism. I know you didn't ask about that, but you know, Plantinga is on record as dissenting from some theses of classical theism, like simplicity, immutability, timelessness, God being without passions. But he doesn't really do a lot with that. And most of his arguments would go through. With or without that. I mean, some might take that to be a bug, others a feature, but that's just, it doesn't seem like his arguments depend on that. And so the vast majority of his arguments actually in the realm of problem of evil don't really depend upon the actuality or even the possibility of a distinctively libertarian free will. It's just not as central to his arguments here that sort of maybe Christian culturally that's like the perception. I don't want to minimize, of course, his actual commitment to libertarian free will. He thinks it's extraordinarily important. It's why his occasionalism is a kind of modified occasionalism, right? There's space for us to age and cause our own intentions. God's not the only cause in the world, but he's more of a cause than you might think. That's occasionalism. Mm-hmm. So Mackey's argument, of course, famous Oxford atheist, 1955 article on evil and omnipotence, right, claims that there's this logical contradiction between God and evil. They cannot coexist in the same world. It'd be like having an irresistible force and a movable object in the same world. Yeah. There would be an inconceivable smash, right? If God has all power and all goodness, right, then there just won't be any evil because he would have eliminated it. And then, of course, he's able to. So there's a twofold response here. I find many people overlook the first response and focus on the second, right? The first response is an undercutting defeater. Mackey just hasn't made his case. He meets these quasi-logical rules that expound for us what is implied by omnipotence, what is implied by perfect goodness. And Plantinga thinks, particularly with the claim about what perfect goodness will do, it's not really up to snuff. It's really hard to make these quasi-logical rules, these claims that Mackey needs, that a good thing would always eliminate evil as far as it can. Like, that's just like automatically true. And he shows that Mackey can't make the case. So, you know, that's not a rebutting defeater. He's not disproving Mackey's conclusion. He's just saying Mackey didn't make a good case. Now, what Plantinga is really known for is the free will defense. This is the second reply to the logical argument from evil in Nature of Necessity and God, Free and Evil. And here he really is seeking to overturn Mackey's conclusion to prove it false. You say God and evil are contradictory. I say that they are consistent. And he sort of wants to rule out all Mackey-style arguments in advance. Right? Because, Mackey number one didn't give a good argument. Maybe Mackey number two or Schmacky or Wacky, you know, give a different version. I just want to prove that these are compatible. So I suppose you're asking, like, in a nutshell, what Plantinga does is that he comes up with a model in which it can be clearly seen that God and evil are logically consistent. I think it's Doug Guyvett who says in one of his pieces on Problem of Evil that the strength of Mackey's claim is its weakness, and that Mackey, in claiming that God and evil are logically contradictory, you're making a claim implicitly about all possible worlds. You're saying God and evil do not coexist in any possible world. So to refute that, you just have to come up with one in which it's clearly seen that they coexist. Now, whether Plantinga has done this, right, that's open for debate. But the way he does this is he says, well, there could be truths about how we would use our libertarian free will. And so God's omniscient, he's going to know these truths. It's at least possible, since these truths are contingent, right? They're about libertarian free will, right? That these truths reveal to God something. And that is, for any possible person that it was available to God to create, that person would end up doing at least one bad thing in the course of their life. They don't have to be a serial killer like Jeffrey Dahmer or something like that. They could just be, I stole gum from the store, or I had a bad thought about my mother. But, you know, these truths reveal that every person available for God to create would go bad. Would do at least one bad thing. So just imagine that's how the counterfactuals turn out, right? And maybe we could have a separate thing on Molinism, right? But let's say it turns out this way. Well, then God goes ahead and creates a world that ends up having moral good in it. Well, there's a price he pays for that. That's going to entail there's going to be some moral evil. So God goes ahead and creates a world with moral good in it, right? That entails there's moral evil. So now you have a kind of model, a situation in which there's God and evil. And he thinks this is all entirely compatible with God's attributes. Right. Yeah. And all the rest. So I guess you said you didn't want to spend too much time in the logical problem.
No, this is good. I wonder just real quick. So Plantinga talks about how a best possible world is like an incoherent concept or something. You can always add, I think he always says like an extra hula girl or something like that.
This is the material on Anselm when he's assessing the Lost Island objection to to Anselm.
And I wonder if that does that play into the response at all, where God would have to make the world with the least amount of evil or anything like that, or is this just all we need to show is that there's one possible world where God exists with evil? We don't have to go in for and God would have to make a best world or anything like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, in class, I have a little handout where I talked about what Plantinga calls Leibniz's lapse, right? And Leibniz and Mackey both have this kind of like assumption in common that God could have created just any possible world. Mm-hmm. Leibniz uses that assumption to argue from, well, there is a best possible world, and then saying, well, of course, God then would, you know, has the ability to create it. So therefore, like, this world, despite its evil, just is the best of all possible worlds. So Leibniz is arguing on behalf of the angels, as it were. Whereas Mackey, he also holds this view that God could create just any possible world, right? But then he thinks it's just obvious that the best possible world has no evil in it. So he deduces, therefore, this world, our actual world, right, just can't be the best possible world. And so it couldn't have been created by God. If God has the attributes you Christians say, he would have created a better world. Now, Plantinga mainly sets his sights on that premise about what omnipotence could do. And it's kind of like the bizarreness of his claim that God could remain omnipotent, and yet there's possible worlds that he can't actualize. Right. Not because he actually has something, any kind of weakness. It's just because there are these truths about how people would use their free will. But you are right that in addition to making that move, he also expresses some kind of skepticism that there really could be a best of all possible worlds. I don't think just saying that gets you out of the logical problem, because, okay, maybe for any world you think of, you can always think of a better. Right. But Mackey's going to say God should have selected among, you know, the range of worlds that have no evil in them. Right. That kind of thing, or at least a world with less evil or something like, you know, something like that. So I don't think like the bare claim, hey, there is no best possible world gets you out of it. Because even like a Molinist like Plantinga would, you know, I think would think there's at least like, a, I don't know, a best of all feasible worlds or a best among a kind of like, I don't know, range of feasible worlds. And so I have to think about a bit more to.
No, that's helpful. So you've also written a book on the problem of evil, which is really good, and it's written, I would say, at a popular level, which the task is insane. That you like, there's so much deep philosophical stuff, but you pitch it at a level where like a really well educated high schooler or undergrad student could understand it. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember in the book if you take up the distinction between a defense and a theodicy. So maybe I can just random question for you. Do you like Plantinga's distinction between giving a defense and giving a theodicy?
Yes, but this, at least some people think this is, how can I put it? For them, this is non-standard usage of key terms. This is Swinburne's view. Defense that Plantinga's understanding of defense, the way he uses it is just misleading. And again, I have a handout where I talk about the distinction between undercutting and rebutting defeaters, which you might sometimes that maps on to the distinction between defense and theodicy, but actually it doesn't, because Plantinga's defense, so a theodicy is saying like, here's what God's reason is for putting evil, or here's what God's likely reason is, that it comes prepackaged with a kind of plausibility, right? There's at least some kind of likelihood, right? This is God's real explanation for at least an important range of significant pain and suffering in the world. Whereas defense just gives a purely, you know, possible reason, right? It's logically possible, but there doesn't have to be any likelihood. And Plantinga is just saying to answer the logical problem in particular, all you need is a kind of defense. Right. Yeah. But his defense then, even though he's only giving a possibility, namely transworld depravity, I mean, I guess I didn't define that earlier, but that's what I was describing. That defense, it can be used to disprove Mackey's claim about contradiction between God and evil. I sort of acknowledge there's a plurality in the discussion about theodicy and defense. I just make the distinction between undercutting defeaters and rebutting defeaters. To me, this is like the most important and clear distinction to make, and there's more of consensus on what we mean by these terms, right? Again, an undercutting defeater simply looks at someone's argument and says, well, maybe your conclusion is true, maybe it's false. I'm not going to like get into that. I'm just saying you didn't give a good argument. So skeptical theism is like that. Skeptical theism, as you find in Plantinga and maybe like in Bergman and Howard Snyder and a number of other authors, right, is a kind of undercutting defeater, just say, well, he who affirms must prove, your evidential argument from evil seems to assume something, that if God had a reason for permitting evil, that reason would be discernible by us. And since I just can't come up with it, it's likely God doesn't have a reason, right? They're committing themselves to something. A skeptical theism is saying, well, I'm not quite sure you've borne the burden of proof here. So that's an undercutting defeater. A rebutting defeater then sort of goes on the offensive and overturns a conclusion. So you say that there's no reason that God could have for preventing evil. I say unto you, there's loads of reasons. And then you roll up your sleeves and start talking about soul building and value of free will.
Yeah.
And God painted God's megaphone, C.S. Lewis style. And I do combine both those approaches in the book. I guess your question was about the little book, which is in a series published by Christian Focus, The Big Ten. These books are meant to be handed to even unbelievers who have no familiarity with the Bible. Here's what a Christian would say. I don't claim to represent, you know, all Christians, but I mean, here's what a Christian might say on some of these difficult topics. So it's supposed to be accessible. So maybe for the sake of time, and you can ask whatever follow-ups you want, but my slogan really in the book is that the way of theodicy is the way of the fool, whether you rule it in or out, and it's the way of the wise to know this. So the idea here is that two groups need to learn humility, Christians and unbelievers, non-Christians. Okay. Christians need to learn humility and not going around ruling in theodicy as God's likely reason, right? Yeah. I think critics of theodicy are right, that you could potentially increase the problem of evil in the world by being a Christian like that, who's going around ruling in theodicy, right? But I think it would also be unwise to rule it out. I don't think unbelievers, or believers for that matter, know enough to say, I'm quite confident this couldn't have been, right, God's reason, or that he doesn't have it. So I think it's the way of the wise to know that both these groups, right, can neither rule in nor rule out theodicy. And of course, you only have to say the second thing to sort of deal with a lot of the problem of evil, at least on the philosophical side, I think.
That's really helpful. So the ruling out against the non-believer, I mean, obviously, or maybe not super obvious, but skeptical theism does that and says, look, you'd have to be God in order to know, or, you know, it's inscrutable. God's reasons are inscrutable to a finite being like us. You can pitch it in a lot of different ways. Is that what's doing the work to against the Christian who would say this is God's reason? Or maybe is there more like theology at play where you're saying like, look, dude, you don't know the mind of God. God is not, like, is it skeptical theism that's doing the work against the Christian and the non-Christian concerning theodicy? Or is there more at play, I guess?
Right. Well, part of that, I mean, there's a number of sort of desiderata that are being satisfied in the book.
And, sure.
And I don't want to give the impression like skeptical theism is like all we can say, you know, like just shrug our shoulders, right? I mean, that's one of the objections I try to deal with at the end of the book. This looks like a kind of giant cop-out, right? Can't Christians do better after 2,000 years or something? So I do give a case that, various theodicies, right, might have some kind of biblical sort of indication pointing in that direction, right? So something like soul building or suffering is something that shapes us or gives us very valuable opportunities, that kind of thing. I think there's a number of passages, right, from Hebrews and First Peter and all the rest that indicate that God does indeed use suffering in that way. Pain is God's megaphone, right? I think Luke 13, Jesus turns around the assumption of his disciples, the Tower of Siloam fell on those people and killed them because they were worse sinners. It was just the judgment of God. And Jesus says, I tell you, but unless you repent, you will likewise perish. He turns it around into like a warning for those who remain, right? Yeah. We're not going to declare this a judgment on those who perished, but it might be in the hands of God, a warning to you who remain. And so he turns it into a call for repentance, right? I do talk about, greater good theodicy, and there's the typical passages for that, whether it's narrative context, like the Job, Joseph, and Jesus narratives, or certain general passages like Romans 11, Romans 8, that kind of thing. So like, we're not like without an ability to say anything about what God might be up to, right?
Right.
Um, But then the idea is, now that these are on the table, what is the case from the unbeliever that these aren't God's reasons? They might say, well, because they don't cover this particular case of horrific evil, right? They might be able to cover these cases over here, but not this particular case of horrific evil. And we might admit that and say, right, there are limitations. And I talk about the limitations in the book. But why think the goods we know of are representative of all the goods there are? And that seems to be an assumption made by the unbeliever when they make a plausible case that, look, there are cases of pain and suffering that aren't covered by your theodicy. Mm-hmm. We might be able to say, well, right, but for all you know and for all you can show, there are goods that God is aiming at, right, that you're not aware of. And so I'm not gonna deny that a kind of skeptical theist approach doesn't underlie, right, maybe even structure a lot of what I'm saying. But I think that approach needs to be blended with sort of articulating specific theodicies.
Yeah. Right? Amen. That's awesome. I think you're totally right there.
You put them together, then when you divide them, but you definitely need to be humble in this matter of theodicy. You can handle theodicy in a way that you actually increase the amount of suffering in the world, because Nicholas Wolters Church's book, Lament for a Son, right? So it brings out like the pain that was caused him by even various well-meaning Christians who came to him and declared various things, after the death of his son. So that's like an essential book that I assign to the student.
Like Job's unhelpful friends, right? Yeah.
Yes, right. See, I see all these themes, here, like clearly God is aiming at great goods, right? The vindication of his own name in the face of Satan's accusations. But of course, he doesn't clue Job into it. Meanwhile, his friends just go for a punishment theodicy. And God says at the end, you guys didn't speak rightly of me the way Job did. So notice there's a number of things that went on here. There is a kind of theodical angle here in Job. God is aiming at great goods by way of various pains and sufferings, either their actuality or possibility. But at the same time, he's leaving created agents in the dark. So I find both these sides of the issue, that they're like slammed together with no apologies in passage after passage after passage. And I think that's just potentially significant.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I think that's actually a really good segue to the evidential problem, to Roe's argument. And then just covering a couple, we don't have to go over all of Penninga's replies. Again, I wish we had 15 hours, but there's so much to this book, which is really impressive that you can fit all that in there. But can you broach Roe's evidential argument for us?
Right. So, in one way or another, so this is a kind of more modest alternative to Mackey's logical argument, which just claimed that, just one speck of evil in the world would decisively disprove God, right? It's not about amount of evil or the horrific nature of evil. It's that there's any evil at all is supposed to constitute a decisive disproof of God. And a kind of consensus has emerged, not universal, a kind of consensus has emerged that, Plantinga sort of maybe disposed of that, right? And his way of doing that in the mid-70s sort of, again, helped to put him on the map, right? And gain him readers for subsequent philosophy, particularly in the realm of epistemology and elsewhere. So the evidential argument is really that evil constitutes strong evidence against God's existence. It may not, strictly speaking, make God's existence impossible, but it makes it unlikely. Just as if you were to go to Metropolis and move there and people say, hey, this is a great place, Superman's here. And then you're wandering around Metropolis and you see school buses filled with children going over bridges. You see, all of these these buildings burning down and, people are like, where's Superman? Is he in the bar flicking peanuts at the mirror? Or I guess technically it's possible Superman lives in Metropolis, but it seems really unlikely, right? And so that's the flavor of the evidential argument from evil. So you think of Roe's article, William Roe, the friendly atheist, from the fawn that burns to death in the forest fire, right, after suffering in agony for multiple days. And so Roe is running through the typical theodicies, right? And he realizes they can't apply, these can't easily apply to this case of animal suffering. It can't be like Bambi needs to suffer so that his character gets shaped, or that he responds favorably to the gospel, or has an opportunity to exercise his free will, right? And so he picks this case of suffering because it seems to be particularly difficult for Christians to explain with the traditional theodicies. And it was a catalyst for animal suffering to be a more prominent part of the discussion in free will studies. So then what do you do with this? What do you do with this argument that says it's just the profusion of evil in the world, the seemingly gratuitous nature of it, the horrific nature of some of it, right? That maybe like Marilyn Adams speaks eloquently about, makes it really unlikely, right? So this is where I identify five different replies that Plantinga gives to that argument. And so, I don't know how much we can get into it, but one reply is to sort of give up the ghost and say, yeah, you might have a good argument. Okay, you're right. Strictly speaking, if I just focus on evil, that makes the existence of God less likely than it would otherwise be. But then he makes the fairly pedestrian point in a very humorous context, though, that might not be all the evidence we have to adjudicate the question, right? It might be that there's a lot of good pro-God arguments, right? Including arguments about how we need God to sort of make sense of our intuition that there's a way things ought to be, right? In the first place, which is sort of what's driving the problem of evil in the first place. Why are they so convinced there's a way things ought to be? You know, that kind of thing. So this is what I mean. I think I say something like contextualizing the problem of evil within a larger body of evidence. So this is the Fichte as a Frisian stuff, right? Fichte as a Frisian. This goes back to, his Dutch upbringing, right? And 9 out of 10 Frisians can't swim, right? They just don't swim. That seems pretty likely in that evidence that Fichte can't swim. Right. Okay. Slam dunk. We have an evidential argument against Fichte being able to swim. That's sort of like the evidential argument against God existing. But then Plantinga says, but maybe then we learn something new, a new piece of evidence. It's completely consistent with the old piece of evidence. I mean, it has to be for this to all be coherent. So we have a new piece of evidence, and that is that Fichte is a Frisian lifeguard, and 8 out of 10 Frisian lifeguards can swim, right? Right, I mean, I feel bad for the people who are with the 20%, on the beach, can't swim, right? If something happens.
Right.
Okay, but now with this new piece of evidence, it's no longer unlikely that Fichte can swim. Now it's very likely he can swim, right? And that's because this is because the likelihood and unlikelihood of a claim is assessed relative to the body of evidence data that you're considering. And so maybe that's how that is with the problem of evil. Interestingly enough, Swinburne takes the same view in his book on the existence of God. He's giving positive case for God. And then he sort of pauses and says, now, what about the problem of evil? And his view is that God's existence definitely takes a hit from the problem of evil. The likelihood of God's existence, may very well go down because of this evil, but he doesn't think it takes an insuperable hit. And so there's the pro-God evidence, the variety of it, the profusion of it, all the rest sort of outweighs, what can be done with this anti-God evidence. And then I think maybe like religious experience comes in and wins the day at the end of the Bayesian argument. It's the scales, which is all you need for his sort of Pascalian kind of basis for going down the religious path. But anyway, that's Swinburne. But so that's the first reply. Second reply is to adapt the free will defense. And I find that a lot of people miss that. And I think maybe I might have missed that. And that is, people always think, oh yeah, free will defense, that refutes Mackey and the logical problem of evil. Well, actually, if you go a little bit later in God, Freedom, and Evil, he appeals to the aversion of the free will defense to defeat the evidential argument. Because what he says is that if you think that it's really unlikely that God exists, then you must think the following claim is very, very unlikely. And it's what I call the no better balance claim. It's something like, for all you know, like all the evil in the world is broadly moral evil. That means it's either brought about by human agents or by fallen angels abusing their free will, right? So natural and moral evil both get explained or maybe collapsed on this view, right? There was no better balance of broadly moral good as compared to broadly moral evil that was available to God to bring about. Well, what the advocate of the argument for evil has to say here is, well, no, there was a better options open to God. And so given that this is the world we find ourselves in, it's really unlikely that God exists. And so Plantinga says, well, if you're committed to that inference, you're committed to the unlikelihood of there being no better balance. Now, how do you know that? How do you know that that claim is unlikely? The truth of that claim depends on what the counterfactuals are. For all you know, there are these counterfactuals, and they go the way that this claim is saying there was no better balance. It's not like unbelievers have some cosmic book of the counterfactuals they can like page through and go, oh, look, this is what God was faced with, right? They don't have access to such a book. So they actually can't make a case for the unlikelihood of that claim. But the evidential argument is committed to that claim being unlikely. So if I could lay it out, I would give the whole modus tollens structure to the whole thing.
But sure.
I found it to be a very ingenious adaptation of the free will defense in a probabilistic context, right?
Yeah.
And so it's often overlooked. Third reply is to critique the probability theory that evidential arguers use, whether it's logical, objective, personalist probability. Please don't ask me to explain this any further. Essay. Right. It gets reprinted in the Howard Snyder anthology in the evidential argument from evil. The fourth reply is going to be skeptical theism, right? Mm-hmm. So if your hearers want to see this, go to ccel.org, look up Plantinga's book, Warranted Christian Belief, which is made available in its entirety for free at ccel.org. I think Plantinga was like behind like getting that. Read the last chapter, chapter 14. Mm-hmm. That'd be a nice statement of, are God's reasons for evil more like St. Bernard's or more like Noceum's, right? There's an assumption being made here. So I won't say anything further about that, but that's like the fourth reply. Fifth reply actually is surprising, and that is the old Felix Culpa theodicy. For so long, Plantinga had argued that the way of theodicy just is not very credible or plausible for Christians. He just very much was skittish about it, refrained from offering, theodicies, not quite sure it can be done. In fact, that's why I'm giving a defense and not a theodicy back in the 70s.
Right.
Then you get, later on in the 2000s or whatever, and he comes out with O Felix Culpa, like 2004 or something like that. And so he thinks he's hit upon an actual theodicy that is plausible, right? And it involves the adaptation of a traditionally Calvinistic doctrine known as supralapsarianism. And so
this is so wild,
which is about the ordering of the decrees and God's decree to commit the fall vis-a-vis creation and redemptive ends. The bottom line is that God wants to create a top-notch world, forget about whether there is like a single best world, but God wants to create a top-notch world. Number one, every world's going to have extraordinary value because God's going to be in it, because God necessarily exists, if he exists at all. But number two, even within that realm, worlds that have incarnation and atonement are far more valuable than worlds that lack it. And then he makes the argument that if you're going to have incarnation and atonement, there's going to have to be sin. And so there is a theodicy then for why God purposes to permit sin, as it were. It's going to be because God wants to bring about a top-notch world. Lots of red flags might be raised in your mind, as they were with others when they read this essay, including Marilyn Adams, who replies to it. You can get all the gory details in the Michael Peterson anthology in the Palm of Evil, which is probably one of the best anthologies available, I think, just for getting students into the topic. But that struck a lot of people as like, whoa, has Plantinga become a Calvinist? Well, no, not technically. I think he's on record saying somewhere that like the 5 points are logically contradictory. So, just anything contradiction or something. But he's deeply influenced, right, by the Reformed tradition. And so once again, he's deploying a kind of distinctive Reformed doctrine in the realm of more or less secular philosophy to make a point. Yeah. So that's the fifth and final reply to the evidential argument, the way of theodicy.
Yeah. So. Which is, it's so funny to think about this. I don't know if it might be said to be an obscure doctrine, obscure debate between infra and supralapsarianism. It's kind of a word you throw out if you want to impress somebody, maybe in systematic theology circles. And Plantinga just injects that into the popular conversation about God and evil. And I thought that was so wild that when someone showed me that essay, I was like, no way, I can't believe it.
Yeah, there's a it's old now, but there's a Daniel Dennett like dictionary of philosophy or something, all these humorous definitions. And of course there's this word to Alvinize, which I think is a takeoff on like galvanizing your hearers. Instead, it's to Alvinize your hearers. He Alvinized his hearers by refuting a logical problem of evil by talking about counterfactuals. Or, you know, it's basically defined as like this really bizarre claim that's advanced in a serious context, right? Yeah. And so you find that, right? I mean, there's no consensus among the Reformed as to whether we should be superlapsarian or infralapsarian, but I don't know, maybe he's being sort of edgy there and coming out on behalf of some version of superlapsarianism. Though, of course, you know, it's coming out of Notre Dame, right? Roman Catholic kind of environment as well, right? This the O Filius Culpa is from the Easter liturgy, right? I think I give the Latin in the book. And so this goes all the way back to perhaps like Irenaeus, right? So this kind of thinking is not like sprung fully formed from the head of the Reformed Scholastics or Turretin. There's a thinking of Adam's fall being a kind of happy fault. You have to be very careful, of course, how you describe this. But anyway, it's an interesting essay.
Yeah. So you can feel free to punt on this one, but I just wanted to get your thoughts on whether or not the O Filius Culpa is... Does that run afoul of your suggestion that Christians should, you know, not be so quick to rule in theodicies?
Yeah, you've caught me at a bit of a loss because, I mean, I haven't, like, reviewed the actual text of it recently, this essay, right? It's always important to go off of not like, well, I think I remember,
you know, sorry about that.
And then the next moment, the guy's swinging from a noose, right? Because you just convicted him of some awful thing. And actually, this was like a kangaroo court. And you attributed him views that he didn't have about burden of proof and all the rest.
Yeah.
That would be awful.
I'm
doing the Fallen Weevil class this term for the master's students. And I know I'm going to be getting to this essay a little bit later. And there's a reply possibly from Kevin Diller and some others. So I think he conditionalizes, right? Like, given the body of Christian theology, given what we know from the scriptures, it seems really likely that this is like a very plausible theodicy, given the value that we learn from those sources about incarnation and about atonement. I mean, he has some very eloquent passages of like, why would God put his son through such suffering, right? Unless there was something of extraordinary value, right, at stake, right? And he gets a lot of lessons from this as well. So it's different than from like transworld depravity or something, which is like this bare logical possibility. There's nothing that like Christian theology speaks in favor of transworld depravity. You know, he has a joke that, you know, its relation to total depravity is left as an exercise for the reader to work out. But he's not claiming transworld depravity comes from the Christian tradition. It's just a kind of gerrymandering. He likes to do this. Planning is all about I can beat you with one hand tied behind my back. Right. So a bizarre possibility I thought of the other day refutes you, you know, like, Your argument's like a house of cards. Just make it stronger. Oh, I'm going to kick it over anyway, right? I mean, that's his like rhetorical style, which has, you know, left its mark on a number of people. But the O Filius Culpa, I mean, he seems to be like as serious as a heart attack that this is arises quite naturally from the Christian tradition. And as Christians, we are committed to the value of incarnation and atonement playing some role in God's plan for the world and what kind of evil God is willing to put up with. I like the spirit of that, right? I like the spirit of being guided by what God takes seriously. But I think, of course, you have to add a healthy dose of fallibility, right? And our ability to discern, you know, these things.
Well, I really like the O Filius Culpa, and it's probably because I came into philosophy through, you know, Van Til and through Frame, and Frame calls it, I think, like, you know, Christocentric greater good theodicy, and, you know, pointing to the cross. Why is there evil in the world? Well, ultimately, like, you know, God is most glorified on the cross and without sin. And so it's very similar, insofar as I'm getting Dr. Frame right, to the O Filius Culpa. And I also take your advice really seriously and, like, you know, look up to you a lot. So for me personally, I'm trying to, like, walk the line of how do I say this in a way that's still God honoring? I don't want to say this is exactly what God told me, that this is why he allowed evil, but giving like a plausible story to say, hey, look, this seems like a plausible Christian response, that God, a world with evil is a better world than a world without evil, because we get to have more revelation of God. We get to see that he is the type of God who would incarnate and atone for sins. And in a world where you didn't have that, you wouldn't know God as Redeemer, you know, Savior, you know, all the things that are demonstrated on the cross. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of the insight is, you know, part of what makes heaven to be heaven is that it was preceded by a veil of tears. And it is populated by those who have been redeemed from their sin, right? You can get this just from the songs that are being sung in the book of Revelation, right? Apart from the fall, I mean, whole realms of God's character would be completely unrevealed to us in terms of his compassion and his forgiveness and willing to provide atonement and undergo suffering on our behalf and that kind of thing, right? We wouldn't have an inkling of that. And I agree, the intuitions divide. I think Kevin Diller just says, nope, I don't have the intuition that we need any of that for just a good relationship with God. Just no fall, right, and we're good to go. We have unbroken communion with God, and that's it, right? And, you know, I don't quite know more what to say to that other than, I mean, we may have to take some of our cues from how God has actually governed his universe. And then reflect a bit on Jesus as the lamb slain from before the foundation of the world, right? So the cross just can't be an afterthought, that kind of thing. God knew what he was doing and he was planning the world. There certainly seems to be like prophecy in the Old Testament. This is like something that is planned. And I agree, at one level, this idea of planned evil, right, strikes many people, particularly secularists, but also many sincere Christians as just a non-starter, right?
Right,
it's just entirely offensive. You're writing yourself out of the discussion, right? But I guess I take a few cues from Flanagan here, and I just sort of want to dig in my heels and just say, well, wait a minute. I do think that there are specifics in divine revelation. And so God does seem to have a kind of plan that includes this. We might not have all the clarity we want, thus the debate between infras and supras and all the rest.
Yeah, right.
But the idea that God was like rolling the dice when he created the universe, he didn't create the universe with some kind of plan in mind that involved things. I mean, I totally understand, like, you know, like maybe like an open theist view, right?
Yeah.
Theism actually is like a robust alternative for me. It's one that's extremely fascinating to me. Whether it's other alternatives are not that interesting to me, including Arminianism and Molinism. they don't seem to really provide a big alternative to, you know, maybe what many call the Calvinistic Reformed tradition. I mean, Arminius was a Reformed theologian, so there's
right
to
totally.
Here. So I just would sort of just hold my ground and say I'm sorry, but the idea that God aims at great goods by way of great sufferings and leave created people in the dark, I just see that shaping so many biblical narratives that I would be shocked if, as a matter of fact, this isn't mysteriously included in God's plan. So yeah, I guess I'm saying I think Flanagan's on the right track here, but I understand those who either think they have a principled rational argument against it or just it's intrinsically offensive to them, but you know, I would just continue the conversation, right?
Right, right. Yeah, you don't solve it all with one paper.
I labeled you as, you know, you don't like this, so I guess we can't talk. I mean, you know, I mean, you're a human being created in the image of God, right? I mean, God's called me to maybe influence you for good in the best ways I know how. I think that means not cutting off conversations with you.
So good.
So there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Dr. Welch. This has been so awesome. We've only covered, you know, one chapter. I wanted to ask one last question here, maybe kind of a bonus. It doesn't really follow a ton from the evil.
Okay.
But you have this really great characterization on page 68, where you say it's important to clarify the nature of the support given to the claim that God exists by the various arguments endorsed by Plantinga. And you also say that, you know, we can distinguish at least four possible kinds or degrees of support, and then you list different people with those. maybe I can just, I could read them if you want, or I could just let you, you know, take a whack at it yourself.
Oh, no, you can read. I mean, I have the book over there. I mean, you can read it. I think
let me just read it.
There was a reason really why I laid it out that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's this claim God exists, and then there's different ways that you can support it. The first one, you say necessarily God must exist, and the contrary is simply impossible because God's existence is the very precondition of intelligibility, meaning, and predication. And this is Van Til's transcendental argument. So this is the top layer. Mm-hmm. Then going down a step is God certainly exists because his existence deductively follows from undoubtable premises. That's Thomas Aquinas's classic natural theology. Then taking a degree less, God very likely exists because inductive arguments shows that he is the best explanation for a wide range of empirical data. And that's Swinburne, his probabilistic natural theology. And then the lowest tier is there is good reason to believe that God exists, at least more reason than we had before considering a particular theistic argument. And I believe that's where you put Plantinga, right?
Yeah. I definitely wanted to locate him, right, on this kind of spectrum, particularly because of the publisher of the book, PNR, and maybe likely readers of the book, right? Hopefully it's beyond the you know, reform camp, maybe that's sure. More interested on average in PNR books than others, right? I mean, I'm writing it for multiple groups of people that we could talk about in a moment. So I have this list because many of those who read the book, right, well, you know, where is this located, like with Cornelius Van Til and all the rest? And I sort of wanted to introduce readers to, you know, there's a whole spectrum of what's being done in terms of, let's say, arguments for theism or Christian apologetics. And you can't really do a chapter on Plantinga's method, which is what that chapter is, I think, is what you're talking about, unless you locate him. So I wanted to just be absolutely clear. Plantinga isn't doing that. He's not doing a transcendental argument for God's existence. There's stuff he does that is sort of in the spirit of Van Til, right? Sure. This kind of naturalism defeated argument that he has against evolutionary naturalism, or some of the arguments, I believe they're in chapter 9 of where the conflict really lies, when he's saying there's a lot of like presuppositions in science that would be rooted in like poisonous soil if it's secular soil, but seem to be in very healthy soil if it's theological soil. In fact, various things we believe about the existence of God, his attributes, are being made in the image of God, helps to account for why these are the right things to believe at the foundations of science, and as a matter of fact, have been at the foundation of science. And so he gives a kind of what Van Tilians might hear as theological preconditions for knowledge and science. Yeah. It's not really anything all that strong, but it's a kind of in the spirit of it, right? So right, there's like that level. Then of course deductive natural theology, Aquinas's five ways, that kind of thing. Ed Fasor, right? His book on the five proofs, and he actually relies on my you know, refers to dissertation giving the Augustinian proof. I was very happy that he gave me the time of day, given his various work. But right, there's a whole body of work, sort of more classically oriented, deductive. Then there's Swinburne, right? So after graduating Westminster, I was sort of pushed more in a more like natural theology direction inductively, just sort of considering his approach, his cumulative case approach. I thought that there was an awful lot to it, right? Maybe I'm viewed as apostate in the eyes of maybe some classmates at Westminster. I mean, you just gotta let the chips fall where they may. Right. I found my views on apologetics broadening at Oxford, but I also found that my theology, for whatever reason, was becoming even more locked down. I think it's not that it wasn't before, but I think being in a modern doctrine seminar, being surrounded by particularly just Protestant liberals and hearing them argue,
pushed you back deeper in.
I found my faith being all the more confirmed for whatever reason.
Wow.
But Swinburne pushed me in that direction. I think my first essay I wrote for him, I accused all his whole body of work just totally circular. And you're closet venting, you just don't know it, you know? And he's like, what? You know, and, you know, no, so my system is more like a house of cards. And I was like, that's not a really great metaphor there. It's this, you know, props of this and that kind of thing. And so we went back and forth on that. But yeah, so then there's Plantinga. And Plantinga, of course, doesn't think you can give this sort of cumulative case natural theology that establishes the likelihood of God the way Swinburne does. But he does think that like individual arguments can be what he calls helps to faith, a phrase that he gets from Calvin. So you might want to take a look at a book called The Plantinga Project, which is a 400-page expansion of Plantinga's 24 or so arguments for existence of God. This is edited by Jerry Walls, who was one of Plantinga's students. And then Trent, is it Doherty?
Doherty.
Just a fabulous book. And it, again, it's surprising because it shows how Plantinga has stimulated much discussion in natural theology. The word on the street is supposed to be that Plantinga, as a Reformed epistemologist, has no place for it. But as a matter of fact, he does have a place for individual arguments making for us in a kind of person variable sense, God's existence more likely than it was before I encountered this argument. So, of course, the Van Thielians, the Thomists, maybe even the Swinburnians are going to be looking down and going, yep, that's why Plantinga should be on the fourth tier of the totem pole. You know,
that's right.
I'm not sure what that is doing. We have a better Christian witness than that. But, you know, Plantinga is going to say, well, you know, I mean, philosophy is very integrated, right? I mean, I have commitments elsewhere that preclude me maybe from taking your more majestic projects. I don't know, Mao Zedong, let 1,000 flowers bloom.
Well, that's why I like that distinction that we broached earlier, because I think even analyzing that and saying, well, who are their audiences, that might help explain, the commitments or the types of arguments that are used. I love Van Til. I've read a lot of Van Til, but he's primarily speaking to his, master students.
Mm.
And so if he was speaking to secular philosophers, they might be different, you know, and maybe not, you know, I don't want to psychologize the guy too much, but the audience matters. And so, I think we need to keep that in mind as well. But Dr. Welty, I just wanted to find out, like, where do you find yourself on this descending list?
Yeah, whenever students ask me that question, I always say, oh, my views don't matter. You know, let's get back to our readings now. I think because, though, in the context, you know, there can be a kind of mini tribalism that emerges within any Christian institution, right?
100%.
You're Kleinian, you know, you're a Freemian, you're triple line. This won't make any sense to non-Westminster, you know.
sure.
You know, that
happens
that,
a lot at Westminster, yeah.
It's like really important, right? Where does the professor land? As if like my declaration should have any epistemological weight whatsoever, right? Like,
sure.
Right. Again, philosophy comes down to the arguments.
Yeah. But evidence of evidence might be evidence, you know, for internalists.
I'm entirely happy, and I think it's quite consistent with my theology to have great hope for all four tiers, right? I always say this to my students, particularly those who are interested in like doctoral studies, but like at any level. I mean, we have a PhD program that I teach in here as well as being the program coordinator for the MA and philosophy of religion. But I always say, hey, you know, you've read some things in Van Til. You think that the transcendental argument is like worthy of development and representation, right, in our modern day and sharpening by way of contemporary sources, that sounds like a great idea, right? I mean, it's in Kant for a reason, right? And Van Til sort of adapted that mode for a reason. He thought it really helped remind us of fundamental issues where God's at the center. Yeah. That's not to say that I've ever seen it fleshed out, right? So that it actually tricky. Like shows, right, why God must be a trinity instead of a quaternity or, you know, whatever, right? Or these 66 books and not the Apocrypha, you know, are the precondition of intelligibility, right? I mean, maybe it's can lay that out.
And
I don't want to border a caricature, but I mean, I'm there's nothing in me that rules out that project in principle, right?
Okay.
So I would be quite happy, right, for it to be actually developed. Van Til sort of bequeathed to the next generation a kind of framework, a kind of skeletal structure.
Right.
I think Frank points out he sort of expected the next generation to fill this in. right? I don't know how well it was. I'm quite happy with, you know, some of the arguments that Ed Fazer, you know, presents in the Five Proofs, you know, book, sort of more in the spirit of deductive natural theology, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I could go down the list, right?
Sure.
And,
right.
And say, yeah. I'm happy. So, I mean, true confession time. So I used to be more like what Frame calls a movement Bantillian, which was that any sort of move from the master inevitably involves compromise. And then Frame, of course, shared his book manuscript. Both Frame and Bonson wrote a big book on Van Til and a little book on Van Til, right? Frame's big book on Van Til is Cornelius Van Til, An Analysis of His Thought, right? And chapter 15 on antithesis is worth the price of the whole book. And there, I think he brings out how possibly Van Til may have exaggerated this antithesis, right? And so for Frame, that's a kind of backdoor to bring back in some of the more classical evidential modes of, argument. So I'm pretty Framian, right, on this, point of view. But I don't know. I mean, that opens up a lot more things for me. So I still have like the theology basically that Van Til has, but I no longer hold to the alleged methodological implications from that theology. So the idea in Van Til is supposed to be, if you hold the total depravity, if you hold the absolute sovereignty of God, if you hold to the absolute authority of God's word, maybe there's a couple other distinctives, then of course you will only use transcendental argumentation and you will never use classical or evidential argumentation. I'm completely on board with all of those distinctives, but I no longer see them having the kind of like apologetical straitjacket kind of implications, right? That's cold comfort for those who think otherwise, you know, and they would like me saluting the theology and then giving the Heisman to the methodology. I'm happy with the methodology. I just don't like limiting Christian apologetics. It's a blade on the Swiss Army knife of Christian apologetics, transcendental argument.
Yeah.
But I do think that I can incorporate it into a larger vision that, you know, that's being worked out by people in your neck of the woods in Florida or whatever.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, I seriously appreciate it. And there's a lot of folks like I'm on that same trajectory with you. I have tried to work out transcendental arguments and, I have one that I'm working on, from Donald Davidson and James Anderson's been helping like retool stuff and slapping stuff down. But when you go to actually try and make one, it's really tough to like establish the impossibility of a contrary type stuff. It's just hard. So I appreciate your words. I appreciate the broad camp notions as well as holding, you know, firmly to the theology, because that sometimes that goes when people do this. So yeah, just wanted to say as we're closing up here, like just a thank you. There's a lot of us who look to people like you and Anderson and some others and just say like there's guys doing it in the same mode that we want to do it with the same theology that we want to continue to hold on to. So yeah, just a thank you from a lot of us.
Yeah, well, no problem. I told you before you started recording, you know, I mean, I don't think there's anything like intrinsically evil about social media and podcasts and all the rest, but I don't know, I feel like not that I'm Aquinas, but I mean, if Aquinas had access to email, I'm not sure we would have like the summas and all the commentaries, you know, and things like that. I mean, you sort of have to, I don't know, sequester yourself away, right? I mean, of the making of many podcasts, there is no end, and much videoing wearies the body. So I find on social media that there's just a particular way of presenting people that, you know, leaves me very discouraged, right? People always put their best foot forward and I'm always reading, you ought to be this, you ought to be that. The one thing in the Christian life is this. Here's this one thing you cannot miss. Yeah, well, when you read that 20 times a day, apparently there's 20 things I cannot miss. And pretty soon, you know, I'm like an utter failure. And I just had to make a decision, which had nothing to do with like the morality of it, but the practicality of it. So it might be though, I mean, if your viewers get a lot out of this podcast, they want more. I mean, I'd be happy to come on again. I mean, I don't know, you know, do more edgy issues. My two theological objections to Molinism and my three philosophical objections.
Bullet Bill would be a good one. I know. Yeah. Wow. Right. All right. Well, you guys heard it, folks. So let us know in the comments that you want to have them back. Maybe we can convince them.
Molinists are our allies, though. They are our allies in defending the full omniscience of God.
Okay, there we go.
Awesome. And in many other, yeah. Much else besides. Okay.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Dr. Welty. This has been fantastic. Folks, go ahead and grab the book. It's Alvin Plantinga in the Great Thinkers series for Presbyterian and Reformed.
Yeah, there we go.
I'll leave a link in the description. That's right. All right, folks, that's going to have to do it. This has been Parker's Pensees. And as always, all glory to God.